Coming up Saturday morning at 6 on Hometown Heroes, we'll hear from participants in this week's Central Valley Honor Flight from the historic runway at the former Castle Air Force Base.
13 wounds, only 5 of them were serious, but I still have shrapnel in me today.
Hear from veterans, the guardians who helped them, and even Power Talk's own Dave Bowman on Hometown Heroes. Saturday morning at 6 a.m. on Power Talk 1360 and 1280.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are people around you who really have done heroic things for the sake of our freedom. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we are educated, we're certainly entertained, and oftentimes even inspired by these stories from America's greatest generation. Inspired, moved, and humbled would be a few of the words that describe what I felt this week after an amazing honor flight experience with 66 veterans from California. You've heard me talk about the Honor Flight Network, volunteers all over the country making it possible for World War II veterans to visit their memorial in Washington, D.C., and to do so free of charge. It's happening in every area where Hometown Heroes is on the radio, and I've encouraged you before to get involved with Honor Flight wherever it is that you live. Where I live is Central California, and if you're a longtime listener to the show, perhaps you followed the development of Central Valley Honor Flight, which, thanks to unbelievable community support, just concluded a remarkable first year of flying. Wednesday, October 29th marked 1 year since the first Central Valley Honor Flight took off from Fresno. And on Wednesday, October 29th, 2014, our fifth flight in those 12 months came home. 66 veterans and their guardians touching down on the historic runway of the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater to a giant red, white, and blue crowd and some incredibly emotional moments. The Atwater High School band was there playing all the military hymns. The cheerleaders from Buhack Colony High and Merced High were there with their pom-poms. Countless color guards forming an avenue of flags, and the veterans wrapping up a 3-day experience with the homecoming of a lifetime. 62 men and 4 women from 8 different counties in California, and every single one of them has a story to tell. We had a sailor who survived the sinking of the USS Yorktown, men who were wounded at the Battle of the Bulge, 4 female veterans on the flight, including 2 Navy waves, and we're going to hear from another wave and an anecdote that's sure to give you a chuckle. They represent all branches of the military, many different ethnicities. They range in age from the mid-80s to 98. That was our oldest vet, and he still runs an exercise class in Merced. But at least one thing that they all have in common, a love for our country. I hope to bring you some more of their stories in the future, because there are some doozies, but we're going to hear from a few of the folks on that flight today. This first one was recorded while we were at the World War II Memorial. The entire group stood at attention as an 88-year-old Army veteran, Donald Dick of Visalia, played taps on his father's World War I cavalry bugle. And then the veterans and their guardians fanned out to take in this memorial built in their honor. I noticed one veteran had finished touring the memorial and he'd settled into a spot to rest, so I struck up a conversation. And once I started talking, I decided I better record some of this for you, because it was pretty incredible stuff. You'll hear the rush of the World War II Memorial's fountain in the background, and you'll hear from Charles Steins, who was there with his son, Daryl, serving as his guardian. Well, Mr. Steins, first of all, what does it mean to be here at the National World War II Memorial and see what America and many of your fellow World War II veterans have built for you?
Well, it's amazing. I believe the most interesting thing to me is the humane factor of what the people are doing now for us, the volunteer work that goes into it, and showing to take us and help us see this beauty and see what we've done.
And I imagine it means something to you to share this with your only son.
Oh, absolutely. He is an Army veteran also. He was in Korea up on the DMZ in the Army of Occupation for 18 months. So he's has a little flavor of the Army in combat.
And he wouldn't be here if you didn't survive World War II, and that wasn't easy for you. You went in before Pearl Harbor. Where were you on December 7th, 1941?
I was in a rental automobile coming down from Fort Lewis, Washington on my very first furlough. I got down to Portland, Oregon when it came on the radio, and they said, all military personnel get back to your base. So I had a half a day of that furlough. I went through the entire war. I went through 4 years and never again even started on another furlough. I never had a chance.
Thanks a lot. And you ended up in the 3rd Infantry Division, did you say the 15th Infantry Regiment?
Right, that's right.
You ended up in the invasion of North Africa?
I made the beach landings and made the invasion. We went in at Casablanca and then turned and went across through the Atlas Mountains into Tunisia, and we got stopped by Rommel. Field Marshal Rommel put a stop to our advance.
There aren't too many of you left that were part of that early action for America in World War II. How severe were those circumstances? How fearful were you that your life might end there?
I mastered my fear. I was always responsible for a group of men, and they were my primary interest. I was so busy watching out and making sure everything went right that I didn't have time to worry about myself, which was a lifesaver for me.
I guess so. And what kind of unit was that? That was an infantry, a rifle platoon, or what?
It was a regular rifle platoon. We had three platoons of riflemen and one platoon of heavy weapons, and I was in charge of the machine gun section through most of the early days of the war. Later on, I got promoted out of my job, so I lost my machine gunners, but that was what I loved and what I did best.
And you said you guys were driven out by the Desert Fox there, General Rommel. I imagine that means there were heavy casualties. Did you lose a lot of friends there?
Quite a few. I lost a brother-in-law who happened to be in the same outfit. But actually, we don't say Rommel drove us out. We just retreated a little bit. We withdrew. We didn't retreat. We didn't go very far. He only wanted to get through to get on a boat and go back to Germany. So we got by pretty good. The original soldiers that came, landed over there and fought, they took very, very heavy casualties in the Tunisian area. They were right up against the desert there, against Rommel. The German army was good enough to help them there. Then we never made any advance into the desert. So it was a rough war.
Well, and now you can look back and you know what happened. But at the time, when you're facing that, you're overmatched, you've lost your brother-in-law. I mean, that had to be pretty hard to deal with. How did you get through those kind of challenges?
I didn't have time to think about that. I had to live in the present day to day and just do the best you can. I think most of us that were in combat after the first few days realize you're not coming back, so quit worrying about it. Just do your job. And that's the way it turns out. So I think we had the right mentality to survive.
Well, you made it here. You must have done something right. Did you have some close calls there in North Africa?
Every few minutes, I guess.
Can you give us an example?
Well, I can't remember a very close call down there. One of the things I remember about North Africa was my first time I got to meet General Patton. It was early in the morning. I had a machine gun roadblock on a road. We hadn't gotten into town yet, and General Patton came up on a light tank behind me, and he asked me if there's any reason he couldn't go to Casablanca. And I said, well, nobody's been in there yet. He said, that's not reason enough. He kicked his driver and went into Casablanca by himself. A great man.
So those people who say our blood and his guts, you say no, he had plenty of that himself, huh?
Oh, yes. I met him again in Sicily. We were going advancing from the south up towards the north coast, and we were advancing through a German depot, ammo depot, and it had been set afire and ammunition was blowing up and exploded all across the road. And we came to a fork in the road, and General Patton was standing out there directing traffic. His Jeep was turned upside down on the side. I asked him what happened. He recognized me, and I said, what happened? He says, oh, we hit a damn landmine. The driver was dead, but he didn't get hardly hurt. But the thing that amazed me, he was standing there cool as a cucumber directing us down the different routes where we belonged, where we went.
Did you ask him to hold his Pearl pistol?
No, you don't ask General Patton anything. You don't tell him anything either.
You mentioned going over to Italy as well. What do you remember about the landing you made there? Can you paint a picture for us to understand what you saw and experienced at that time?
That was our worst landing, because now we're coming into the European country proper. It's not the same as taking an island or taking some land. Sicily was a rough fight because they wanted to hold us back as far and as long as possible. But you mentioned little incidents, and one that always comes to mind is as we were advancing across Sicily, we came to the Italians built rock walls everywhere. We come to a rock wall and you had to go over it. So I told my men to hold up. I was going to go over and see what was on the other side, and put my rifle on my back, went over the wall and landed on the back of a German. And of course, I grabbed him in a bear hug. And my rifle was on my back, and I kicked his rifle over against the wall. I found out in a minute, because he kept hollering at me, "Achtung, Achtung, Minen, Minen." He's planting landmines. He'd planted a whole field in mine. That was his job. And he just finished planting it in mines, and he wanted me to stop dancing around and not kick one of the landmines. So anyway, I told my man to hang on, don't shoot him. I was sending a German over the wall and send a runner back to company headquarters and tell them that it was all mine, we couldn't go through there. Anyway, that was a memorable part of my campaign in Sicily.
I would say so, and I know you're not asking for this, but it strikes me that if you hadn't figured that out, a lot of guys could have lost their lives.
Oh, well, we saved each other's life every few minutes in that war. We all looked out for each other. And I remember one time in Italy, I had a combat patrol. I was going on a very narrow path with a rock wall on my left and a cliff on the right. And I had a first scout out, and I was second. Something caught my eye, and a German hand grenade landed right by my feet. I just reached down, scooped it up, and threw it back over the wall. Didn't even think about it. But it went off just as I went over the wall, and I heard a German screaming, so I got him. Anyway, just little incidents like that. You help each other, and you don't think about your own safety. You don't have time. You can't afford it.
Until you're actually wounded.
Yes, finally, I'd been promoted to staff sergeant about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We're getting ready to build up an attack to cross the river. I got promoted to staff sergeant and given charge of the whole platoon. And I thought, well, that's pretty nice. And that was about 4 hours before an artillery shanted landed, Cheryl landed, and took me and my first scout out. And that was the end of the war for me.
How close to you did that shell hit?
My first scout was about 15 feet in front of me, and the shell landed between us and killed him instantly. So it somewhere between nothing and 12 feet, you know, it was right there. I heard it coming, but it was so close by the time I heard it, it went off just before I hit the ground.
Do you remember that first scout's name?
No.
It probably was hard to remember names with so many coming and going, huh?
Hard for me to remember your name now.
Mine's not important, but those gold stars over there, there's 4,000 of them representing 400,000 Americans who died in the war. And does that make you think of people like that scout? Because that could have been you, right?
No, you do. You think back on people, but there were so many. Like I said, in one battle, the last battle of Sicily, it was our final attack. We were trying to break down the reserve, keep them from getting back to Italy. We fought for 5 days and nights. In one night alone, we lost 41 men, and we were down to about 180. So they go come and go so fast. You get a new man today and tomorrow he's gone, so you don't remember. It's over and over and over again, you know.
How many of those who you started with were still there when you were wounded?
There was 12 men of the original 124 left that night. The Italians had given us, was passing out free bottles of beer to us. They were so grateful. So we had a little party that night, and we got together, and we asked all the old-timers to get together, and there were 12 of us.
Wow, that was less than 10% of what they started with. We're going to take our first break, but when we come back, Mr. Steins will describe the extent of his injuries And I think, like I am, you might be amazed that he's still with us. 93 years old. It's amazing he even survived the war. If he didn't, his son Daryl would have never been born. We're going to hear from Daryl as well. And if you'd like to learn more about Central Valley Honor Flight or any of the Honor Flight hubs around the country, just go to honorflight.org and find that group in your area. Hometown Heroes is coming right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, giving you a taste today of the power of Honor Flight, a nationwide effort to get our World War II veterans to their memorial before it's too late. I had the privilege of going with 66 veterans on the latest Central Valley Honor Flight from the historic runway at the former Castle Air Force Base. What an experience that was. So amazing to see people come together and make it so memorable. If I started thanking all the people who had a hand in it, I think I'd take up the rest of the program. So let's get back to the story of Charles Steins, 93 years old. He lives now in Fresno, California. But this interview took place at the World War II Memorial, thus the sound of the fountain in the background. And if you listen closely enough, you might hear some of the spontaneous applause that is so common at the memorial when World War II vets come through. The third time Mr. Steins was wounded, yes, I said the third different time he was wounded in the war, was an incident in Italy where an artillery shell landed between Mr. Steins and the soldier 15 feet in front of him. Think about that, how close that must have been. The other man was killed. Mr. Steins was nearly killed. How many different spots did that shrapnel get you? How much pain were you in? How severe were those injuries?
I had 13 wounds. Only five of them were serious, but I still have shrapnel in me today from my throat was cut. My left hand was almost blown off, and our fantastic medical staff, the doctors and nurses, was awesome. And how they patched us up and put us back together is unbelievable. And I'm so forever grateful for that.
How long was your recovery?
What year is it now?
Still recovering, huh?
I haven't recovered yet. I'm still in a wheelchair, you know. So, when I got out of the Army, after a couple of days short of a year, I was on crutches when they discharged me from the Army, using a wheelchair and crutches. It took me about 3 or 4 years to where I could get around without, just walk without assistance of anything. So it was a long, slow process. My right knee and my right hip was both shot out. So it was all on one side. But the recovery was actually very final. Later years in life, I didn't really suffer any anymore.
Have you ever set off a metal detector because of all that stuff still in you?
No, but I have to, when I go in to take x-rays, they warn me to tell them where the shrapnel is, because yeah. So when they take an x-ray, they want to know what those blobs are, and I know exactly where they're at, and so I can warn them. But I've never set off a metal detector. The heavy metal is down on my hip and my right knee. I had a piece in my forehead, they got out. And one went in, that cut my windpipe, went down in my chest and disappeared. Nobody knows where it's at. We haven't found it, but it's still in there somewhere, floating around.
Well, I'm just listening to you. And you know, I've interviewed hundreds of veterans and lots of guys who've had a lot of injuries. But it just strikes me when I hear about you jumping over that wall and landing on the German and landmines all around, or this shrapnel hitting you and coming right through your neck, And I think you just said severing your windpipe and then coming through your midsection and still in your leg by your hip. Boy, there are a lot of things that could have taken you out. Do you feel like someone or something was protecting you?
Yes, myself. I protected me. I'm not religious. The third day in combat, I lost my religion. When I seen men killed, wiped out around me, good men, and drunken bums live, and certain circumstances. The first German I shot close up, we came around a corner together. I happened to have a Tommy gun. I was on a beach landing, so I carried a Tommy gun always. And he come around, he had a rifle, and of course he raised his rifle to shoot me, and I brought the Tommy gun up and cut him down. I went over to look at him, and his eyes were still open, and he was looking at me. And he was a lad about 14 years old. And I had quite a conversation with God and told God what I thought of him and the way he run the war. And I've never been in a church since. But I don't mind, and my religious friends don't mind, because I tell everybody I'm fighting for their right to believe as they wish. But I'm going to insist they let me have my rights to believe as I believe. I'm very much at peace with it.
Got it. Well, I want to say thank you for serving. Thank you for telling me that. It helps us understand this price that's been paid for our freedom. Is there something that you think people like your son, future generations of American, need to know about what you and all those other guys did?
Well, what I'd like to give all the young people is I think the answer to our survival and our future is education and intelligence. Try and pursue knowledge and help other people to better knowledge. That I think this is the only way we'll ever get improved.
What does it do for you to have this experience, not by yourself, but with all these other World War II veterans?
Very comforting to be with a bunch of men that understand me, because people like you never will really understand me, because if you know without going through it, you have no way of knowing what it was like. So we have a lot of good times kidding with each other and talking, and they may be a sailor or they were a Marine or someone, it doesn't matter, you know, but they were in it. Once you're in it, you learn what it's like. So it's wonderful for us to get together like this. I'm amazed at the amount of time and energy that our men, young men, especially some of the younger women and men and women that donate to see that this works. I appreciate it very, very much.
Well, and maybe you're one of those listening right now who has donated to Honor Flight. Whether it's $5 or $5,000, you are making a difference in the lives of men like Mr. Steins. And I don't know about you, but I cannot imagine being in the position that he was in. If you go to the Hometown Heroes Radio Facebook page, you'll find a photo of Mr. Steins with his son, Daryl. You heard his dad mention that Daryl is also a veteran. He was in the Army during the Vietnam era. And those are some of the other people whose lives you touch when you support Honor Flight, the family members, especially those who get to go on this flight as guardians. Let's hear from Daryl about his experience.
Well, it's great to have this experience of spending time with my father, other than just a quick visit. We've lived kind of far apart for several years now. These last few years, we've been getting together more and more, so this is a great opportunity to spend a whole 5 days with him.
What have you learned about him these last few days?
Well, I've learned a lot because he's talked to some other people and told some stories that I haven't heard yet. Thought I'd heard most of them, but there's always seems to be more.
And when he was telling me about all those injuries, and then I asked you about, you know, what was it like growing up? You didn't know what he'd been through or how severely he'd been wounded or any of that, did you?
No, not really. I knew that he'd been wounded, but he never talked too much about it. I knew the locations of some of his wounds. But to me, he was just my dad. He was just a guy, and he didn't act like a disabled person. Turns out he's 40% disabled, but I never knew that, and I don't think most people that knew him ever knew that, because he didn't show it.
What I'm sure there are a million different things you could think of, but when you've seen him out here, you've seen him experiencing this, you've seen him around the other vets, and you think back on your whole life and what you've known of him, what makes you the most proud of him?
Well, I think what makes me the most proud of him is a lot of what's always made me proud of him. He's got tremendous determination. And I think probably a lot of these guys that came up in that generation, they grew up in a depression, went off to a war, That's an early life that the rest of us have never had, and we'll never fully understand it. And this experience with all of these guys together kind of helps you get a feel for the kind of people they are. And I'm kind of proud of all of them, and I've always been proud of my dad. No, it's just been a great experience. I think the honor flight is a really great thing for these guys to have to be recognized like this, which they haven't ever had. And I see a lot of them appreciating it. It makes me feel good, makes me happy, happy for them. I can tell by the looks on their faces. This really means something to them.
It sure does. And the story you just heard from Charles and Daryl Steins, father and son, was paralleled by so many families on the honor flight. It takes countless volunteer hours, incredible community support, but I'm even more convinced now than I was before that it is the righteousness of the cause, the importance of the mission, that causes so many people to give so generously with their time, talents, and treasure. We took several members of the media on the flight, including Dave Bowman, an 11-year Navy veteran who served on nuclear submarines, but now is a popular talk show host in Modesto and Stockton, California. He's the afternoon host on one of our Hometown Heroes affiliates, Power Talk 1360 and 1280, where the show airs every Saturday morning at 6. Dave spent time on the trip taking photos and interviewing vets, blogging about it, and I thought it would be good to get his perspective on what he saw and what he felt in his experience with Central Valley Honor Flight. I'm sure you had some respect for the World War II generation just being in the military, but to spend these 3 days with all these heroes, what have you gotten out of it?
Well, it's I have a connection. My grandfather was a World War II vet. My uncle Mick was a Navy vet. So standing there at that World War II memorial with those guys was just, it's very awe-inspiring to watch them come into that bowl and then gather together, get that picture taken, the people greeting them as they come in, and then to watch them go around and find the state where they, I mean, we're all Californians, but most Californians start somewhere else. And I went to the Oklahoma Pillar just to kind of pay tribute to my grandfather. And Frank Guns, I guess, was from Enid, Oklahoma, and he met me there. And we just started talking. You know, he told me the same joke my grandfather used to tell me 30 years ago. It was hysterical.
You got to tell us a joke now.
Nah, it's not, it's really bad. It's really, I mean, it's not arable, but it's bad, and it's silly. It's not good.
Well, good. Keep it to yourself then, yeah. And I know that you're a student of history, and a lot of this was familiar to you, but what are the things that you've learned or gained a deeper understanding of because of this experience?
I've learned several things. Number one, veterans we've got to get their stories down. I mean, I've known that for years intellectually, but now you feel it. Now you actually see it, and you start talking to these guys, and the stories that they have to tell are so amazing. And it's not just the guys, it's the gals, too. That I learned this morning when we were at the Women's and Military Service in Althea, I believe is her name. Her picture comes up on the thing, and she's sitting there below that, and everybody just sort of gathered around. And I think the third thing I realized, I had a veteran actually say this to me, there's a reason why there's two straps on your backpack. It's a whole lot easier to carry it that way. And it is with one, and they probably learned that hump in the jungles of New Guinea or something somewhere. It was really good.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. I'm sure there are a lot of your listeners, and I'm sure you're going to be talking about this on the air, but that say, is this really something that I should be involved in, that I should sign up for if I'm a veteran, or that I should go on if I'm the son or daughter of a veteran? What would you tell those people?
If you're a World War II vet and you haven't gone, there's no question you should. If you're a veteran at all and you want to be a part of something very special, you should sign up to go for this as a guardian or whatever roles there are. If you're a son, a daughter, a relative, a grandchild, you're going to see a side of your grandparents, your parents, whatever, that you've never seen before. And yes, you should. Everybody should be doing this. This should almost be mandatory, but I don't think Congress could pass that law. I mean, it really is amazing.
It would save us a lot of work if they did and funded it for us.
And it's not just, you know, you asked me the other day what the most amazing thing I'd seen was. And it's a little unfair because the World War II thing is the vets are fantastic. But I had an opportunity yesterday to walk the Vietnam veteran wall with a Vietnam vet who had never seen it before. And that was really impressive and really emotional. And the whole thing together just and his service to these World War II vets is, it's keeping faith. That's what he was talking about, keeping faith. He's keeping faith with them. He's keeping faith with his brothers. And it just goes forward from here. Support Honor Flight. Donate cvhonorflight.org. Even a dollar helps. Every little bit helps. Support it as best you can. And if you can, go.
Well, that's certainly how I feel about it. And it's encouraging to hear other people saying the same thing. Thanks to Dave for his perspective and his service to our country. Honor Flight is a pretty contagious thing, I'll tell you. The adventures in Washington are amazing enough, but I can't say enough about the send-off and welcome home we had in Atwater at the place that for more than a half century was Castle Air Force Base, named for a World War II bomber pilot named Frederick Castle, who rose to the rank of general and died in the cockpit on Christmas Eve 1944. It was a mission that earned him the Medal of Honor because of his heroics, which allowed five members of his crew to survive. The last stop on our honor flight in Washington, D.C., was the beautiful Air Force Memorial, where three spires appear to reach all the way to heaven, where the panoramic view of our nation's capital is just about unmatched, and where atop a panel on one side of the memorial is inscribed the name of General Frederick Castle. So that was one of the last things we saw there. And when we landed at the old Castle Air Force Base, the veterans were greeted by just an amazing crowd. So many people doing so much to make it all possible. And I really hope that we can do that again and continue to find ways to really let these veterans know how much we value what they've done for us. Still more to come on this edition of Hometown Heroes. We're going to talk to a doctor who delivered more than 12,000 babies and hear his World War II Navy story. That's when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Instead of just one person's perspective today, we're getting a few, giving you a bit of a taste of Honor Flight through the most recent Central Valley Honor Flight that took off from and returned to the historic runway at the former Castle Air Force Base in Atwater, California. On the flight, there were men and women with remarkable stories, significant military medals, more close calls than you can count, and incredibly emotional and powerful moments throughout. The four women veterans on the flight included two Navy WAVES, Women Accepted for Voluntary Emergency Service. And they would be very surprised by what we're about to hear from one veteran who says he has a story nobody else can tell. His name is Harlan Ellis. He lives in Visalia, California. And let's find out just how unique that story really is.
When I was 16, I didn't want to go in the Army, so I joined and signed up for the Navy. They told me to that they would call me when I'd be called up. Of course, I was only 16, so they weren't going to call me at 16. I lived in Vallejo, and they said, go up to Sacramento Junior College and start taking classes, and then we'll call you when we want you. So two of us went up there, George Hilton and myself. This is a true story exactly as it happened. And it's in March 19th, I believe, and we were in a French class. Now, what I'm doing in French, I can't speak French, and I don't know why I was taking French class, but we were taking a French class. And right in the middle of the French class, two Navy yeomen walked in the room and said, we need Hilton and Ellis to report to the 12th Naval District immediately. In those days, I mean, the class got up and they clapped. My girlfriend came up. She kissed me goodbye. She started crying. And you know, we were just like heroes. So we packed up our stuff, went down to San Francisco to the 12th headquarters, 12th Naval District. We went up, towed us up to the fifth story of one of the buildings, and we went in, and they said, yes, you got to talk to the captain back there. And he says, oh, yeah, Ellis and Hilton, okay. And so we got back there, and he says, look, I've got orders for you guys to be on a troop train tonight leaving Oakland for Philadelphia. We said, great. Well, we're packed up. We're ready to go. He says, there's a problem. It's a WAVE troop train. This is an absolute true story and exactly what it way it happened. And he said, we've got your serial numbers mixed up. And you guys are members of the WAVE organization. He said, you've got to stand up. We've got to WAVE you. We've got to swear you out of the WAVES, give you an honorable discharge, and then swear you back in the Navy. At any rate, that's an absolute true story. We said we'd go, but they didn't have that in mind. And they said, go back up to Sacramento, and then we'll call you. So we were going back up to Sacramento, and we realized, how are we going to go into that French class? What are we going to tell them? I mean, we started dreaming up stories, we swore we wouldn't tell them anything, and we tried to dream up some story that they had us signed up for, to be future spies or some crazy story. Anyway, we never told anybody, and yet the Vallejo High School, which somehow got hold of this story, and the Vallejo High School newspaper, the Red and White, had on their headlines of the next issue, Ellis and Hilton join Waves. And now, true story. That's the end of the story.
The question is, did you ever try on the Wave uniform?
We just didn't get that far. We were ready.
I like to ask everybody about December 7th, 1941. Everybody seems to remember something. Do you remember where you were and how you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor?
I remember walking to school on a Monday. And, of course, Pearl Harbor was Sunday. I may have known about it Sunday, but I heard about it Monday morning, just walking to school with some kids, and somebody said that Pearl Harbor had been bombed and we were in war. It was that day that President Roosevelt declared war. We soon found out that all of us were going to be drafted, and I lived in Vallejo, and that was a Navy town. There was a great tendency to want to be in the Navy. Some recruiters came through our school. They said if we sign up early and we can finish our high school early, we can sign up for the Navy, and they'll send us to college. I was wanted to be a doctor, so I was signed up for a pre-med program. We were in it about 6-7 months, and suddenly they decided they needed people in a midshipman school. Out of the blue, one day, they give me orders to report to Cornell in New York, University of Cornell, for a midshipman school. I spent 3 months there, became an officer in the Navy.
Now, you just said 3 months you became an officer. Did that make you a 90-day wonder?
Yes. Yeah, I've been called that many times. 90 days, I wasn't a wonder, but I was 90 days.
You were wondering, how did I get here?
Oh, I sure did. And suddenly, I'm walking on a ship, a little Corvette, English-built Corvette in Boston. That's where my orders were. Here I am, 18 years old. I'm an officer. There's only 10 officers on this ship and 90 enlisted men.
Well, maybe they heard about your experience in the Waves. That's why they promoted you so fast.
I covered that up so good. Nobody knew about that. My parents didn't know about it. I think I looked like I was 15. Here I've got guys that have been in the Navy for 20 years saluting me. And I was assigned as a navigation officer. I never had a drink, a cup of coffee in my life. I never had a cup of coffee in my life. But on board ship, you had coffee, you know, and they re-cook it. I mean, it was the worst taste, but I wanted to be one of the guys. I learned to drink coffee.
You say Corvette, and some people think of those Chevrolet cars that go 150 miles an hour, but that's not what you're talking about.
Not quite. Corvette is a ship, an English-built ship. Early in the war, we sent, of course, tremendous convoys from America to England. Obviously, that's where England got all its supplies and men and everything. This is World War II, of course. The ships did great, but as soon as Germany figured out what was going on, I guess, they built a fleet of German submarines. They just started sinking a great many of the convoys that went across. So at any rate, America built 20 destroyer escorts to escort the convoys and protect them against the submarines. But the destroyer escorts couldn't handle the North Atlantic seas. Would go through one wave and slap the next wave. Repeatedly doing this, they would start developing leaks, and they couldn't use them in the North Atlantic. America gave 20 destroyer escorts to England, and England gave 20 corvettes to America. America used 10 corvettes in the North Atlantic, 10 in the South. The British used the destroyer escorts in the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. There's 10 corvettes, and every time a convoy would go out, the 10 corvettes would surround this convoy, and we would go about a third of the way across the ocean. That's about as far as we could go and then come back. And the convoy usually would be on its own about a third of the way, and then the Brits would pick them up. So our biggest enemy probably was the ocean. That
Well, you can say that now, but I'm sure you didn't know that at the time. I mean, there was the threat of German submarines in the area, right? That's the whole purpose of you guys being where you were. And weren't you expendable if you're on the outside?
Well, I suppose so, but I think the thought was that German submarine probably wouldn't want to waste a torpedo on a little corvette. We always had that concern.
And you said you were a navigational officer on the ship. What did that consist of on a corvette?
Keeping us on the right track. We'd be told to be at a certain place at a certain time. My job was to get out maps and kind of get us geared to that spot.
What did you take your readings with to know what your coordinates were?
Well, we always had stars and things like that, but we didn't.
What, no GPS?
No GPS.
And I'm picturing one of your grandkids listening to this, and that's, well, I have GPS. Before all that technology, you mentioned the stars. How do you do that? Explain to us how you could figure out where you were just by looking at the sky, assuming it's clear.
You can get readings, like you say, if it's clear. If it's overcast, you get no readings.
So then what do you do?
Whatever direction you're going, you know how fast you're going, and you know what the speed of the current is against you. You calculate from there.
Well, and I guess the question that comes up, how much responsibility did that make you feel, knowing that everybody on that ship was dependent on you doing your job right, or you could be all alone in the middle of nowhere?
Well, I really think the captain knew more about it than I did anyhow. So,
does that mean he had to set you straight a time or two? Did you get off course?
He let me know, but we didn't have too much problem that way.
I talked about German submarines, and I don't think too many people have ever heard much about Italian submarines. You guys actually came across one of those in the Atlantic?
We did, and it was toward the end of the war. Somehow we felt that this Italian submarine was on its last leg. It was long distance from home. It basically surfaced and surrendered to us, really. I say we captured it, but that's not really true. It really surrendered to us, and then we escorted it back into Boston.
In all your time in the Navy, what was the moment where you felt most concerned or were afraid that maybe that was going to be it for you, that you wouldn't come home and get to pursue that dream of being a doctor?
We've had a few storms that we were in, and I think our biggest danger probably was the storms.
How bad were they?
We had storms where we would go through a wave and dip down and water would come over the top. It would almost go in the stacks. The key was for the captain never to get the ship turned sideways in the trough, because you would go down. And there were two or three corvettes that went down out in the Pacific because they got in storms that they just couldn't handle.
And what do you do when your ship is going through a storm like that? I mean, are you holding on to anything you can find?
Yes, you sure are. We lost one man overboard. We don't really know how that happened, but it did happen. I mean, once you're in that storm, everybody has life jackets on, and you just got to be extremely careful about moving around. But I don't really remember a time when I thought, boy, it's all over, or I'm going to talk to God or something. What am I doing here or something?
Well, you talk about what am I doing here. I always think about the people who wouldn't be here. How many, you have five children? How many grandchildren and great-grands you have?
Well, this involves a couple of marriages. We'd count 25 grandchildren and 23 great-grandkids. Got two more on the way.
Well, and there's another twist to that I want to get, but the other thing that occurs to me, how many babies do you think you've delivered in your medical career?
Well, I delivered approximately 300 a year for 43 years or so, something like that, right up until I retired.
So we're talking about, you know, 12,000 babies, and some of them are probably listening right now, and maybe they don't even realize it. And that takes us back to going back. I talk about your kids and babies that you've delivered, lives that you've impacted, but your life was impacted before you were even born with a story of the Navy in World War I. Tell me about that.
My father was a chief machinist mate in the Navy. Their ship, and I wish I could tell you the name of the ship, it came into Oakland, and it was due to go up to the Aleutians and then come back down. Well, right at that time, my mother was nearing birth of her first child, and my father, who was the chief machinist mate and very close friend of the captain of the ship, they got talking, and the captain says, look, why don't you stay here with your wife, and we'll go up and do our deal, and come back, and when we come back, we'll pick you up. He obviously accepted and stayed with my mother when she had her first baby. But the ship got into a horrible storm up in the Aleutians. In fact, it was such a horrible storm, the ship sank. Everybody was lost. My dad later on was assigned to the USS Pennsylvania, but he was a very top chess player. And I have pictures of him playing chess on the USS Pennsylvania, the very same chessmen that he's using on that picture on the USS Pennsylvania, I have in my living room sitting on my chess set.
Yeah, that's a great heirloom to hold on to. But the implication is that, you know, everybody, their parents expect them to love their siblings, but I guess you had a pretty big reason for loving your sister, because if she hadn't come along, you never would have happened, huh? Your dad would have died on that ship.
Yes, when one of my sisters had a 50th anniversary, and I gave the little beginning, I introduced my sister, and my sister had a cerebral palsy, and she had a basic real problem herself. But anyhow, I introduced my sister as saying, the reason we're all here is because of her, and then I listed off all of my sister's kids, and because without her...
And this is probably a tough question to answer, but when you consider that, where does that take you? I mean, is that a humbling thought to consider what might have been different and how many things wouldn't have happened or would have been different?
Wow, boy. Yes, it's very humbling. I believe in God very strongly, believe in Jesus Christ. It's just hard to understand things that happen for a reason. Maybe it was supposed to happen. I don't know.
Well, maybe he knew you were going to come to Washington, D.C. with your daughter and... October of 2014. What's been the highlight of this honor flight experience for you?
Meeting all the guys that are here that really, a high percentage of them were really in the war in the sense that they were being shot at or in real physical danger. I just never felt like, even in these storms, I just never felt really fearful in that way. And I think that hearing these stories that these guys, many of them went through, it's great. And it's amazing that the community got together and would put on a program that is just unbelievable as far as organization, of flying us from Castle Airport to Washington, D.C., and going to all the monuments. It's just phenomenal, I think.
Not to belabor the point, is there any one moment that you think of through this trip that I know a lot of people have said thank you. Some of them you knew, some of them you didn't know. Is there one moment that really made you feel, you know what, maybe I did do something worth celebrating and people really do appreciate me?
Well, I think as we walked through some of the monuments and areas as we went to the Smithsonian and so on, teenage kids would come up and say thank you. And says, hey, I'm not sure I deserve that, but it made you feel good.
Well, that's the idea. Thank you, Mr. Ellis, for your service to our country. His guardian on the trip was his daughter, Susan Daughters, who came down from Boise, Idaho to share the experience with her dad. Let's find out what the experience was like for her.
Extremely emotional, because I think growing up with my dad, who is a physician, who I've lived and breathed medical world, and he's always been on the forefront of natural childbirth, and that's always been part of our family's life as well, that I think it kind of overshadowed his Navy experience. And so I've been hearing a lot of the stories again, but maybe with new ears, and just really appreciating everything that he went through and did, and that he was a part of it for our country. And it was very emotional for me throughout the day, and as well as hearing all the other World War II veterans and their stories.
I know he's listening, but I can tell you're pretty proud of your dad. What makes you the most proud of him?
As a father. He's just been somebody that's always been there for us, and I think that I assume that even back in the World War II, during that period of time, that he was always there. He's such a good listener, and I think he was probably just there for anybody that was willing to need him.
Well, all these men and women were there when our country needed them. It is such a privilege to show our appreciation through a cause like Honor Flight. If you want to see photos from our experience on this Central Valley Honor Flight from the former Castle Air Force Base, I took a lot of them. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and you'll find them. We're out of time this time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.